Welcome to the Revolutionary Health Podcast. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I am a licensed clinician in search of how to live a meaningful and healthy life. I challenge both traditional and functional medicine ideologies in search of truth and wisdom. I allow room for curiosity and always keep an open mind. I enjoy deep conversations with my guests, giving them a safe space to share their research and personal observation, as I feel both equally contribute to the body of knowledge and human experience. Note that the opinions of my guests do not always reflect my own, whether I share that openly or not. And of course, the podcast is for educational purposes only. We do not offer medical advice. So grab a cup of coffee and join me for some intimate and unique discussions about finding wellness in the 21st century. Welcome to Revolutionary Health. My name is Stephanie Center. I am your host. Thanks so much for joining us today. We have a lot to cover, so I will be brief. Today, I am sharing with you part two of my discussion with Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. on the topic of vitamin D, and specifically in this conversation, its relationship to vitamin A and why that's important. If you have not listened to part one, you may want to go back and listen to that first. It's episode 49. And we walk through more of the basics of vitamin D in that discussion, whereas today we will dive more into the weeds. This episode is available on YouTube. Both Morley and Jim share slides that really illustrate what they are saying. So if that interests you, feel free to hop platforms and listen and watch on YouTube. If you enjoy this episode, please consider sharing this with a friend or a family member. Ratings and reviews also go a long way. I do not advertise for this podcast or use this platform to generate income. It's really important to me to hold a safe space for sharing valuable information that isn't muddied by advertisements or conflicts of interest. I really value your trust, and especially if you're on a healing journey and you've been looking for answers for a long time. So that's really important to me. And all right, I think that's it for housekeeping. If you are not familiar with Morley or Jim, they are the most knowledgeable people I know on this subject matter. They are both extremely inquisitive and very humble, which is a great place to be when you're reading research. I also like that neither of them are doctors. They gain their knowledge out of pure curiosity and a discipline for reading. And they're both open to being wrong or changing their minds. And I think that that's really an important quality to have when you are going through research and you're constantly learning new information that you didn't know before. I really want us to break from the idea that only doctors can be experts. I personally don't know any doctors that have a thorough understanding of vitamin D metabolism, just because that's not a part of the medical school curriculum. So just a friendly reminder that the letters at the end of your name are not as important as your willingness to learn. All right, everyone, please help me in giving a warm welcome to our guests, Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Revolutionary Health. I'm back with Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. for part two of our vitamin D discussion. In case you missed our last episode, well, I'd highly recommend you go back and listen to it first, because I feel like that will prepare you for what you're going to learn today. But just a little recap of what we covered. We talked about why 25D is not a great assessment for vitamin D deficiency. We talked about why storage D is not a good marker for sick people. We talked about why there is no benefit to having a storage D over 21 when the current recommendation is in a range of about a 30 to 100. And we even dive into who created that range and why. We talk about the Epstein-Barr connection and vitamin D's connection to autoimmune diseases. We talk about how vitamin D is metabolized, and hint, it requires magnesium. And then we dive into how vitamin D depletes vitamin A and what that means for your susceptibility to illness. So those are the things we covered in the previous episode. So if you have questions about any of those items, I recommend you hop on back and listen to that. It's episode 49. And today we're going to start off, I think, where we left off, basically. I'm really excited to have you both here. I look up to both of you so much. So thank you for being here. And I don't know if you want to introduce yourselves. People probably know who you are already, but you're welcome to say a sentence or two, and we can dive in.
Well, Steph, I'm thrilled to be here. Morley Robbins with the Magnesium Advocacy Group, but also the RCP, Root Cause Protocol. And I'm tickled to have the chance to have these conversations with Jim. He's a busy guy. He's a very popular guy. And I quite selfishly I love having this conversation because I get to ask all my questions and he's very gracious about answering them. So I can't wait to have this follow-up dialogue. And as Jim has already alerted, we're probably going to need a third conversation to get done. So folks, get ready. This is going to be a fun exchange. And I feel the same way Steph did after the last conversation. Pow. Like my mind was like popcorn for like maybe about 4 or 5 hours, Jim. I was like, I didn't know that. Oh my God. And my favorite part about the conversation is I just love the ease with which you started this whole journey was, folks, 25D is a storage molecule. What's it doing in the blood? It's not supposed to be in the blood. It's like, and no one thinks about that. And the parallel issue is cholesterol. Cholesterol is supposed to be in the liver. It's not supposed to be in the blood. And when it shows up in the blood, that means a sign of stress. But no one thinks those simple, profound thoughts. So I really enjoyed that observation on your part. It set the tone for the conversation. I can't wait to see what we find out today when we're together.
All right. Well, Jim Stevenson, I have the Seiko Steroid Hormone D page. I'm what do you call it, Morley? A citizen scientist, researcher who looked into this for a family member to try to understand what was going on with the deficiency because everything was blamed on low 2,5-D. And the first thing I discovered was that there was an active form, and I sought to understand whether or not testing that. And found out how hard it was to get tested.
Yeah, that's right. Was there ever an explanation given why they don't do the active? Did the doctor ever comment on that?
Well, there a lot of the papers will have, they'll have their reason. The circular citation people we talked about last time that support the belief that 2,5-D is the molecule to measure, they base that on its half-life, saying it's more stable in blood. And that there's way more of it, that there's different units of measure for the active versus it. But they give you the impression that that means the other one's not stable. They try to steer you away from the fact that it's the one that does the work and that it doesn't have a seasonal variation. It has a diurnal rhythm, and it's the reason we take the vitamin D in the first place. So there's little nuances in the way that each one of them says it in their papers. But that, in a nutshell, they just say there's less of it and call it not as stable. And it's just kind of ludicrous when you realize what it does. It's the one that does what you want.
Fascinating. Just before we started, I got a random email from someone up in Massachusetts who had been diagnosed with optic neuritis. And of course, the ophthalmologist gave her high doses of D because that was going to cure it, right?
Somehow, yeah, they think it cures everything.
And she's a hot mess now. She's just her copper iron metabolism is just wacko. And I said, "Do you know what the ITIS stands for in like neuritis?" Or she goes, "No, what?" I said, "It's the iron seeker." And she laughs. She goes, "That makes perfect sense." And like just, and what people don't realize is when you start flooding the body with a bunch of D, it's going to really mess up copper and iron big time. And we'll obviously have a chance to chat about that, but that's not a commonly held understanding.
Right.
People don't know that at all. And it's unfortunate because I think there are a lot of people who are taking this supplement, not knowing that there is a price to pay for it.
Right. Oh, yeah. And they find out the hard way, if they ever find out at all. I think a lot of people don't ever find out that there's a downside or it's part of their downturn. You know, they just keep believing in it.
You know, one part that has intrigued me is some people who take these high doses of vitamin D get massively elevated calcium levels.
Mm-hmm.
But not everyone. And I've never really understood what the tripwire is. I just know from my conversations with Fred Kummerow, who was a world-renowned lipidologist at the University of Illinois, trained at UW-Madison, when back when it was a really preeminent institution for lipids. And he did a study over a course of like a decade where he was studying the use of vitamin D supplements in swine. He said, what you may not know more, there's the circulatory system of the pig and the human are just about identical. With the exception of the liver, the pig has the five-lobed liver, which is kind of weird. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I think inside we're very, very close. But I'm wondering, his conclusion after, I think it was 12 or 13 years of research, was you never should supplement with vitamin D.
Right.
He was adamant about it. And what would explain why some people are really reactive to it in terms of their calcium stores going up? I've never fully understood that. Do you have any perspective on that?
You know, because they're not measuring 1,2,5-D, it's really hard to say exactly what's going on with a lot of them. Because that is one driver. It's not the only one. The other molecules will influence the calcium, especially now we're talking kind of about hypercalcemia here. Yeah. So a lot of times people will just end up with hypervitaminosis D and they don't develop the hypercalcemia. So I think it just depends on each individual and whether they've had a bolus dose that can dysregulate them and things like that. I think it's really complex. And unfortunately, they're not really studying that. They don't try to see where the people are garnering their calcium from when they're upping their serum vitamin D. Is their diet adequate? And if so, or is it coming from bone through resorption? Or how is it happening? And I just did a very large hypercalcemia post on my Substack.
Right.
I think I had 22 or 24 citations in there talking all about it. And I think another thing that I should definitely mention is I think it depends on whether or not they have any kind of comorbidity, especially granulomatous type disease, sarcoidosis, TB, cancer, because those things will then definitely lead to hypercalcemia in that case.
Why is that? Why would tuberculosis lead to calcemia?
Because the granuloma is a ball of macrophages that wall off something they can't kill, and macrophages activate vitamin D as part of their deal.
Of course, that's right. Okay, you're right. Yeah,
right.
That extra renal, right?
Right. In fact, it's even in these cases. They say that some of that 1,2,5-D can spill into the blood. It's called ectopic production.
Wow.
ETOPIC. And so it's from an unknown or unexpected source.
Right.
Yeah.
That's mind-blowing.
Right. And in fact, that I have a slide here that I could share that... Yeah. And I might have shown it. You'll have to enable me to share.
Yeah, I have to remember how to do that.
That's okay. I have nothing but time. Putting you to the test, huh?
Yeah.
Now that I've learned how, I'm going to be greedy with the screen sharing.
I love it. Here we go. Make host.
Okay, let's see if I can do this. I'm trying to remember how I did it last time. And let's see. Let's see if that works. Are you able to see that?
Not yet.
No.
Not yet. Well, then I really don't know if
I remember. Did you click share screen?
Yeah, I did. Let me make sure it accepted that.
Yeah, okay. It showed you as host. Here.
Here we go.
There.
Oh, okay. That's one of my favorite slides, Jim,
from
Mangan's classic.
Exactly. It is. And it's right from one of her PowerPoints. And so on the right, the sick one is where they try to not check it, number one.
Right.
And then they also try to explain it away. This is, I think we talked about this last time. They try to say partially treated deficiency leads to high 125D. So this is getting at what I was just saying. Those sick people have ectopic or extra renal production that ends up spilling into the blood.
Right.
And that's how that happens.
Yeah. And just so people understand what's going on, because I think this is a really, really important issue. The there's a mechanism in the immune system called acute microbial peptides. And the active form of D, does it stimulate acute microbial peptides, or is active D, is it actually an acute microbial peptide? Does it serve in that capacity?
Oh, that we had that slide last time, and I showed you all the different cells that let me turn this off so I get back acclimated here. Gets me a little confused. Okay, so that's one of the VDREs. So that's one of the things that vitamin D in its active form by working with retinol create, those antimicrobial peptides. And I'm trying to remember, there were 12 or 14 from the vitamin D receptor. And then they also came from the thyroid and other places. So that's where a lot of that comes from.
Well, what's important for the listeners to understand is, again, we live in a world where people are led to believe that they're anemic, mm-hmm. and that they need more iron.
Right.
And what's really playing in the background is there's a difference between iron in the blood, like shows up on a blood test, versus iron in the tissue. And there's a known fact that vitamin D supplementation is going to cause a rise of iron in the tissue. Well, what's that going to do? That's going to attract more pathogens.
Right.
Microbial pathogens, acute microbial pathogens.
Yeah.
And when D is rising, and especially active D is rising, it's going to push down retinol. And when retinol goes down, that's when it's called the HAMP gene, H-A-M-P, and that stands for hepcidin, acute microbial peptide. And when the HAMP gene starts getting fired up, it starts producing a 25 amino acid peptide called hepcidin. And what does hepcidin do? It shuts down the exit door for tissue to get rid of its iron.
Okay.
And it's not being demonic about it. It's like it knows there's a pathogen. And over eons of evolution, the cells know how to keep that iron away from the pathogen.
Right.
And it makes perfect sense, but it's like, wait a minute, this active D and this hepcidin are causing complete destruction of the exit door. And who's supposed to be running the exit door? It's copper. As I call it, acute, C-U-T-E, acute doorman. It's a copper, it's a copper doorman. And most people don't know that. And so when the iron starts to build in the tissue, then that's when the chaos ensues in the immune system. And that's when people go to the doctor and doctors say, well, you're anemic, you need more iron. And it's like, oh, that's exactly the last thing you need to do. And that's where the real confusion seems to rise.
Right. I agree. And they have a very specific form of anemia of chronic disease.
Right.
And 125D actually tries to play a role in removing iron from blood too. So they're getting hit from both directions in a deficiency, iron and vitamin D, where neither one is real. And then all of the pathogens love to use iron. They have a symbiotic relationship. I think Lyme is the exception, and it's manganese dependent rather than iron.
Right.
And so, but other than that, and so almost all the people that are being diagnosed that are sick with anemia, they have the anemia of chronic disease. The last thing they need is more iron, more vitamin D.
Right. And for the gearheads out there, there's a very famous study done article was written in 1946 by George Cartwright and Max Weintraub at the University of Utah. And they were the first to really identify this concept of anemia of chronic disease, or it's also called anemia of chronic inflammation.
Right.
And so, and the, what's real important for people to understand is that the the expression of the anemia in iron deficiency and the expression of the anemia in chronic inflammation is identical.
Mm.
And in the anemia of iron deficiency, you better have some iron. But in the anemia of chronic inflammation, the last thing you should put into that body is iron. And, right. And actually, for the listeners who are really kind of intrigued by this right now, there was a very famous study done by two world-renowned scientists, Otto Warburg and Hans Krebs.
Right.
And Krebs worked for Warburg from 1926 to 1930. That's kind of mind-boggling to think that they were workmates. And
right.
What's really funny in the literature is to see the arguments they would have about whose idea the study was. But they, in 1927, they decided to bleed birds to the point of near death, because that is a true state of anemia. That is, I think it's the first recorded study of anemia of iron deficiency. The birds were just about dead. And they wanted to see, how does the body respond to that kind of stress? What's the enzymatic response to that? Because the body's going to respond with something.
Right.
And they were studying pigeons and geese. And what shocked them was to find that there was a threefold increase in copper enzymes in the pigeons and a sixfold increase in copper enzymes in the geese. And that... what that study signifies is that copper regulates iron, and that in a true state of iron deficiency, which these birds were existing in, their bodily response was to bring copper to the crisis to enzymatically make iron available to make new blood. And it's a stunning reversal of truth, because you would think, well, of course, we just need more iron. And the story of copper's role in iron metabolism is completely suppressed, completely blown up in a thousand different corners around the globe. But it really gets at this whole dynamic of the body knows when it's under stress. And if it doesn't have oxygen, that's stressful. And if it has too much, that's stressful. And if it can't activate it, that's stressful. And there's actually a concept of cellular fear. And Federico Gonzalez Lima at the University of Texas in Austin, he and his team have been studying this concept of cellular fear. And I've often wondered, what if they shifted their gears and started looking at what is all this vitamin D supplementation doing to cellular fear? I would think it would be showing up in droves.
That's interesting. I don't know how you remember all that stuff.
I mean, my gosh. No, this is, I'm, you know, Jim and Steph, I'm in an altered reality right now. It's just like, I'm absolutely fascinated by the facts that are out there. If you've, if you did for them, just as you've done, Jim, folks think I do a lot of research. Oh my gosh. I think Jim could run circles around the two of us, Steph. But it's like, once you get into it, it becomes a point of fascination.
Oh yeah.
You really want to find out who done it. You want to find your Sherlock Holmes hat. You really want to get down and look for those fingerprints and look for the clues to find out who really, was it the butler in the dining room with a candlestick?
Right.
It's wild.
Well, so I want to summarize this thought, because I think you're talking about something really important, and I want to make sure that Nancy in Missouri understands this.
Absolutely.
So some common themes that you both brought up today are in traditional conventional medicine, we're looking in the wrong place and for the wrong thing.
Right.
And I had this aha moment actually when I was driving the other day, a lot of the women that come to my practice have been told that they have low thyroid and they have been given Synthroid, which is levothyroxine. And what does Synthroid do? It bumps up T4. Mm-hmm. Well, for many of them, because we'll run a whole thyroid panel, for many of them, they're not converting T4 into T3 in their liver. It's a more of a liver issue. And what's happening is they're increasing their T4, and they're further plummeting their T3, increasing their reverse T3, and it's exacerbating the issue. And I just kind of had an aha moment of, oh my gosh, well, this is the story of vitamin D. This is the story of iron, right? We're looking at the wrong thing. We're giving the wrong advice, and we're looking at these things in all the wrong places, right? Because we're talking about storage D is what's the focus, right? And we're talking about iron, which is the focus when it should be copper.
Exactly.
Just for the listener out there who's like, what do I do with this information? Well, and I also wanted to comment on why they measure 25D instead of 125D is part of it because of cost, because it's a pain in the butt to measure 125D because you have to freeze it immediately upon getting the sample.
I thought that was a major driving force, and it should be. But so recently I gathered all of the numbers of, not all of the numbers, let me step back. I asked in my vitamin D group for people that had had their 25D and their 125D tested and to give me the results, please. And after I only had 25 pairs of results, I went ahead and I made a spreadsheet of that. And since then, other people have furnished their numbers to me. And one woman reached out to me the other day in private messaging, and she said, here's some results. And I looked at them, and this person, I don't remember what their 25D was, but the 125D was only in the 30s. And that's actually the lowest 125D I've seen. And then she mentioned to me that the 125D wasn't frozen. And just knowing the half-life of 125D is as low as 4 hours in some literature. 8 to 12 is what I always say. Let's say 12 is the high end of its half-life.
Right.
Just common sense would tell you it needs to be frozen to stay a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. She said, no, they didn't freeze it. And so I went and said, did I come up? I know this is a reality that's supposed to be frozen. So I looked back at Trevor Marshall's work, and right there, he said, absolutely, it needs to be frozen. And then he mentioned that Quest Labs may be the only ones doing it right, and that they won't run a sample if it hasn't been handled properly. They won't even do it. They'll deny it. So if it wasn't frozen on the front end and centrifuged and handled appropriately, they won't even do the results. And so then in his work, I saw it said one of the offenders is LabCorp. And so that got me curious. So I went back and looked at the private message. And we're going to go down a rabbit hole here that is conspiratorial. I got to tell you, it is, absolutely. So I said, well, let me look at Trevor's work again. And LabCorp was the one that she had her daughter's blood work done with. Mm-hmm. So then I thought immediately, being a conspiracy theorist at heart, conspiracy factist, I said, well, who's LabCorp? Let's delve into who LabCorp is. And all I had to do was go mainstream and go right to Wikipedia, which isn't always reality, but it can be a good source on something that's not too conspiratorial. And I was shocked to learn who LabCorp is. And as you look through the piece that they had written on LabCorp, you saw that they were continually acquiring all the other testing labs.
Oh, yeah.
They also made plenty of cancer drugs. They even, from what I was told, I didn't find this myself and I didn't scour it that thoroughly, but I'm sure it's going to be true, was that they actually make Boniva, which is the drug that you get turned to when your bone building ability is gone.
Right.
And they're actually are highly, they're part owned, at least, if not a huge part, with Hoffman LaRoche, who makes almost all of the vitamin C for supplementation and tons of the vitamin D for supplementation. And they say in their own literature that the active form of vitamin D is stable 10 days at ambient room temperature, which is 10 days. at room temperature, which is absolutely ludicrous. How could that even be with a molecule that has a half-life of 12 hours at most? Right. You know, after, you know, a day, you're down to a quarter of what you had. So I started wondering how many of the people's labs were actually, they were being measured much lower than what they really were. And actually, I'll see if I can open this. I have an image of, or I have the spreadsheet here. Mm-hmm. Let me share my screen and show you this. Let's see. I'm not going to probably be able to do that because, oh, there it is. Did that show up?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So the letters on the far side.
Jim, you need to do ratios.
I did have another spreadsheet with ratios, but I didn't put it on here. We can talk about that.
That's fine.
So ratios take a little bit of interpretation, but I do agree. I do agree. And I do have one of these spreadsheets with the ratios, but I don't have it here for us today. The reason there's all the letters on the far side is because some people gave me their numbers more than once. And so say A3, that person gave me their numbers at least three times. But sometimes I only got a 25D. Sometimes I only got 125D. But most of the time I got 125D and 25D from the same lab draw. Okay. But I can summarize what is on this screen. There are 25 different pairings. And out of all those people in the 25D, which is the middle column, and these are sorted by 125D from high to low. Okay. That's what this spreadsheet's showing you. 88% of the people were declared deficient in 25D.
Right.
Zero had a low 125D, in spite of what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
There were 9 here that actually had high 125D, and 4 of them were coupled like that image you just said, Morley, that you really like. Mm-hmm. With a low 25D, and you see those 4 at the very top. They're the first red 25
measurements
you see. Yep. And so who knows how many of those were LabCorp versus Quest done right. So this was pretty interesting to me. This is the kind of data set that you would love to see in a study. When they declare people deficient, I want to see them to be deficient in both molecules, since we do have a range for both. And I think we talked about last time, when they raised the 25D goal, they didn't raise the 125D goal.
No, they did not. No.
Which doesn't make any sense. I'll take this screen off or give you back the screen here.
Sure. And for the folks, for Nancy in Missouri, and that's a really powerful set of data. When you've got low storage, and you have high active, you very likely have an infection. You have some pathogen that's going crazy. Again, acute microbial peptide. That's a very important conserved response to infection. And again, the obvious issue is, if you're not measuring active, how would you know? And then I remember coming across a video by Kenny Merlier, who's a world-renowned endocrinologist. I think he's in the Netherlands. And he talked about the need to have, he said, there's no benefit above 21. He was right in line with the folks at Hoffman's. But he was saying that what you're looking for in a healthy person is a active to storage of around 2-1. That's a good ratio. Well, those people that you were highlighting, those 4, it was closer to 4-1.
Right. Some of them I've seen, there's a lot of 7-1s out there. That's the first vitamin D that when I learned about this, the person that I learned this for was 11 was the 25D. And this was after starting with a level of 23, taking the prescription, having it plummet to 11 because the body didn't want it. And over a year later, getting the 125D measured, and it was 76. So 11:77 is a 7 ratio. So, the ratio is very important. But when I said it takes some interpretation, people need to realize there are people out there that are able to raise their 25D. Those are typically the people that don't have a comorbid condition.
Right.
And so they can move closer to a one-to-one, and they're good, especially if they aren't having any kind of inflammation. They can move their 2,5-D into the 40s, you know, regardless. They may be taking pills, but they still will only have a 40 or 50 in their 125-D, and that looks good. But at that time, they're just getting away with taking the vitamin D. It could easily catch up with them. And then you have the people that have, they are having their inflammation and their body is sequestering the 25-D. So the ratio gets more and more skewed. But you also, and one of the interpretations has to be, the 125-D doesn't have the seasonal variation. So it is what it is. It will be what it should be or higher if there are certain things in their body making too much. But is their 2,5-D based upon their seasonal variation? Did they just have their lab drawn in December? And it'll probably be, if they're in the 20s now and they're healthy, they will probably be in the 40s come summer, 50s even maybe, when they are actually making D3 and the body's naturally converting it to 2,5-D.
Yeah. And so it's, I think it's so important for people to realize that there is a ratio for storage to active.
Right.
But there's also a very important ratio between storage D and retinol, which we're going to get to in a minute. But I'd like to come back to, I think, another really important point that you made, Jim, when we last spoke, and that was about the three-part mechanism to get the benefit of vitamin D, and the fact that there needs to be, you got to have active D, very, very important. You've got to have a receptor, the VDR, the vitamin D receptor, which I believe is magnesium dependent, if I remember correctly.
I would assume it is.
Yeah. And you've got to have this other nuclear receptor called RXR. And that stands for retinoid X receptor, which is a really spooky sounding name. It's like, I think I want to change my name, you know, Morley X retinoid, you know, I think that would be a really cool name. But you've got to have all three parts in order to have an active function. In order to have an immune response, you have to have all three, right?
Right. Yeah, you do.
So then let's come back to what Steph was saying. She was talking about clients who are told that they have hypothyroidism, like it's some disease, right?
Right.
And so we're right back to the same dynamic. What folks don't realize is that the thyroid is retinol dependent, because we're right back to the same mechanism. We've got a thyroid receptor.
Right.
Right. And what's it like to pair up with, Jim?
It pairs up with the RXR.
RXR. You can't communicate. It's freaking frack. It can't do anything without the RXR. Right. And if people don't know that, then they believe that their thyroid function's off. And it's not. I mean, it's just you can't produce T4 if you don't have a functioning RXR teaming up with TR. And that doesn't stand for Teddy Roosevelt. That's the thyroid receptor.
Right.
And so those two need to be together in order to have optimal expression. And then what Steph said that's really, really important for people to just to emphasize, this is not the problem. It's the liver, right? That's where all the conflict is. And what I have been shocked to learn over the last decade is the percentage of the population that eats a low fat diet.
I
sit in Starbucks and listen to people order skinny lattes all day long. It's kind of scary, actually.
Right.
People don't have butter in their diet. They're kind of unsure about eggs. Heavy cream? Oh no, I've got to have skinny, right?
Right, right. You know,
beef liver? Are you kidding? I stopped eating that when I was 3. And then cod liver oil. Oh, well, that's really bad. You know, Ray Pete says it's going to kill me. And I'm like,
right. Well, so, and then,
be afraid of the, what's really funny about that is the whole argument is about PUFAs. Beware of the PUFAs, right? Does anyone know how you make cell membranes and organelle membranes?
Oh, yeah.
You better have PUFAs. If you don't have PUFAs, you're not going to make them. So the idea that I'm going to keep them out of my diet, but my body's going to produce them anyway. It's like,
right. Yeah. When your body needs it, it's going to produce it. And if you've cut it short, and we owe a lot of that to Ansel Keys, as you know,
sure.
Go ahead and telling everybody that, you know, we need to change our diet so that we can all get fat and unhealthy, because that's basically the outcome of his guidelines.
Absolutely. But what I want to emphasize is that the point that, you know, Steph is working with a lot of folks who think their thyroid is broken and they have a dietary deficiency of real retinol.
Mm-hmm.
Not beta carotene.
Right.
We're talking about real retinol. There's something called a retinol equivalency unit, REU. And you got to have 12 units of beta carotene to equal 1 unit of retinol.
Okay.
That's really, really important. This idea that, well, it's close enough and you don't need that much beta carotene. No, you need a lot of beta carotene. So Jim, you would need to fill your room with carrots to equal a tablespoon of cod liver oil. And, right. And people don't realize that. Yeah. And so then we get to this idea of a high reverse T3. I just love that term, reverse T3. Wait,
right. No.
Like reverse IQ?
Wilson's syndrome, it was called, there was a syndrome associated with it.
Yeah.
Oh, is that
it's
right?
Almost conspiratorial to want to talk about reverse T3.
Well, thing is, if we've got this T4 is being made here, but I think it's like 90% of the T3 is actually converted in the liver. Mm-hmm. If I've got that right. Right. And so what gets in the way? Iron. Mm-hmm. Iron just... It starts to fill up. Again, let's make sure we're clear. If you have low retinol in your diet and you have low copper in your diet, guess what's going to fill up the liver? Iron. It's going to, and that's what they learned in 1928 at the University of Wisconsin, just before Kumerow got there. He got there in the early 30s. It was about 5 years after they'd made this earth-shattering discovery. And his faculty advisor was the main author of that article in 1928, Dr. Hart. It was a big deal. In any event, if you don't have copper in your diet, and you don't have iron, you don't have retinol in your diet, then iron's going to build in your liver. It's a biological fact. It's not like, well, it's Tuesday and it's in the afternoon. Maybe the little iron's going to get, it's like, it goes like that. It just goes, sinks right into the liver.
Right.
And Kim and Gonzalez in 2021 were able to prove it genetically. It's fascinating, but nobody knows that.
Right.
And so when iron starts to build up, guess what it's going to do? It's going to create oxidative stress. That's not your friend. And it disrupts the deiodinase enzyme. Say that 3 times real fast. I'm glad I didn't have that word in my book. I was stumbling over nuclear and synthesize, and then I had this other word, ceruloplasmin.
Yep.
How many times that word appears in my book? Like 1,000 times. And the engineer said, "You got to do it again. You didn't pronounce it right." I said, "It's my book." He said, "You didn't do it right." Yeah. So the thing is, the liver is full of iron. The deiodinase enzyme. It doesn't just run on selenium, folks. It's got to have copper. It drives the scientists crazy. If you don't have copper, there's 2 selenium enzymes that don't work without copper. They're called selenoenzymes. Seleno, well, they don't work without copper. Guess what? I think they're copper enzymes. So then the reverse T3 builds up, and then people get synthroid, right?
Mm-hmm.
I spell it right, S-I-N, right? And so a very important study, Steph, for you to know about is from Dr. Bert Valley at a little school in Cambridge called Harvard Medical School. And in 1955, he did a study. And let's go inside the mitochondria for a minute, right? And we have different complexes, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we have something called complex 5. Now, 1 through 4 are called the electron transport chain. Just just moving the electrons down, trying to get them to oxygen in complex four so that we can turn it into water so we can release energy. Okay, very important transaction. Well, what happens at complex four is when water gets made, and you got to have the right pH to make water, it's called 7.0. Optimal expression is at pH of 7. And when you have pH of 7, you have this optimal, the mitochondria is basically a water wheel. It's really cool. That's really what its job is to make water, not just energy. And when that happens, it's supposed to, that series of events is supposed to be coupled with complex 5. And that complex is called ATP synthase. It's where ATP gets, it's actually where the ADP that gets released at complex 4 gets turned into magnesium ATP at complex 5.
At the right pH.
Right. And that complex is a rotor spinning at 150 revolutions per second. It's pretty cool. And we only have, we have no idea how many complex fives we have, but here's the bottom line for Synthroid, 1955, Burt Valley. Synthroid uncouples the ETC from complex 5. Now, why is that significant? Because when the four complexes are together with complex 5, it's called oxidative phosphorylation. And your ability to make energy rises.
Right.
Now, here's my theory about thyroid medication. Can't prove it. But what they do is that they provide enough hormone to pass the blood test, but they don't provide enzymatic function. If you have functioning thyroid, you don't have extra weight. You have extra energy.
Right.
And most people who take thyroid meds do not have extra energy, and most of them do have extra weight. Yeah. And so it's this mind-numbing reality that they don't realize where the action is, which is in the liver, how disruptive iron is, how important retinol and copper are to proper iron metabolism. And the world has been trained to believe that, well, the thyroid just works on its own. It doesn't need nutrients. You know, it's like, all you need to know is it needs iodine and selenium, and that's all you need to know. It's like, that's not true at all. And so if you're missing retinol in your diet, if you're missing copper in your diet, you can't flip iodine into iodide. I never know which way I'm going. It's either iodide to iodine or iodine to iodide. That's a copper dependent function. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And so they'll tell you it's ascorbic acid. No, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's copper. And so all this confusion about this endocrine gland that people think run the body. No, it doesn't run the body. It responds to the body.
Right.
Yes.
But it's not running the body. And it's important for people to really follow that thought that, oh my gosh, if it's not running the body, then what is running the body? I mean, it's a really fair question. Right. So it's important for people to be more curious and less concerned. Right. Just be inquisitive and see what don't you know, or find out what your practitioner doesn't know. That's what's really important.
Well, right. you know what's interesting? So the reason I even brought this whole thing up is because, and my listeners know this, but I don't, Jim Morley, I don't know if you know this, but I worked in acute care as an occupational therapist through December of 2020. So I was in healthcare for a little less than 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I was part of a team in the hospital to get Joint Commission accreditation for our spine and joint patients. So I was going through a lot of charts. I was reading, taking a lot of data. And I noticed, I was paying attention because, first of all, these patients were not as old as I would have thought they would be. We had a lot of young people getting cervical spinal fusions and whatnot. But looking at their PMH, looking at their health history, the top two things I saw were iron deficiency anemia and not even Hashimoto's, just hypothyroidism, just mm-hmm. low thyroid. And so I began to ask a lot of questions, like why am I seeing these two things? And then a third thing popped up that I had to look up the first time I saw it because I didn't know what it was. And that was NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And I kept seeing it over and over and over. Now I'd heard of alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver, but I'd never heard of NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, or non-alcoholic fat. This was like a whole new world to me. Right. And so I dove into that piece because that was really fascinating. I've always been fascinated by the liver. And I found a really cool, not cool study, but a really intriguing study that suggests that non-alcoholic fatty liver disease will be the leading cause of a liver transplant by 2028. Right. And so then I kept thinking, well, does the liver play a role in this iron problem and this thyroid problem that we're seeing? And this was before I knew that we were measuring the wrong things, that we were looking in the wrong places, that these things were being stored in the wrong places. And it's just kind of interesting to take this like real world example here mm-hmm. And it perfectly aligns with the things that you all are reading about in the literature.
Right. Right. But
one of the guiding aphorisms of healthcare or medicine in particular is the way it's characterized is not known because not looked for. Now, the corollary to that is I've had several doctors tell me that they learned this in medical school. I know what to look for. I look for what I know. I look for what I know. I don't look outside of what I was trained. I don't look outside of that training. And it reminds me of the famous story of the drunk looking for his lost keys. And he's looking under the street lamp. Mm-hmm. And the policeman comes along and says, what's going on? And the drunk says, I lost my keys. And the policeman says, where did you lose them? The guy says, down the street, but the light's better here. And, and that's medicine. That's medicine all the time. I was trained here. They showed me the light was here. But I know the problem's down there, but I got to stay here because that's where I was trained.
Right.
People don't believe that it's that simple. That's right. Where the mistake is.
Right.
So it's just, we're here to help each other, folks. We've got to support each other through this process of discovery to learn that we're not dealing with a full deck of information.
Mm. Right.
And that's really what these conversations are. I think what I find most enjoyable is we're helping people to become more aware, and know that there is deception with some supplements. And the thing is, Jim, how many articles have you uncovered? Have you ever kept track?
No, I've emailed myself more that I haven't read than I have read, actually. Yeah. I've been trying to get caught up for years, and I still send myself articles every week, and I've made folder after folder in my emails and stuff. But before I forget, or before I lose my train of thought, I want to talk a little bit about the stuff with the liver that we were just talking about, because you tied the liver to iron, we tied this stuff to the thyroid, and then we were talking about the pairing in the thyroid. But last time we talked about how excess 125D will displace the thyroid native hormone. So that's right going on.
You have a slide about it.
And then what's working on the D3, the liver, we're taxing that, of course. Right. And then there used to be really good. There used to be, I don't know the name of it. I could find it, but I have a paper about it. We used to use a different thyroid test. It was considered the gold standard, but along came some quicker, faster, which has always got to be better test that doesn't really put the body through the paces. And when it comes to a thyroid patient, you're always treating a treatment. So you're taking a snapshot of them under a treatment, then you're really tweaking. Only the first time are you really treating the function of their thyroid. And I agree with you, Synthroid is not the way to go. There's something called Nature Throid that's supposed to be really good, some other things. But what were you seeing in your acute care? You said you were seeing a lot of stuff with the spine. Are we talking things like lamectomies because of spinal stenosis and stuff like that?
It was a combination of spine and joint. I don't know if I studied them in isolation. I can't remember. So it was total hips, knees, shoulders, and then also ECDF, so anterior cervical disc fusion, doing T-lift, so thoracic, doing lumbar, and then some, spinal stenosis was a common code for the reason why.
Okay. Well, this might circle back as an answer in part, in theory at least, to what Morley was asking at first. How do these people get away without having the calcium? So I recently was researching spinal stenosis. Yep. And I was looking at some alternative ways to treat it, homeopathic ways to treat it. And I found interesting stuff that said, the reason most everybody's going to end up with a spinal stenosis is from too much calcium in their lifetime. But what drives the amount of calcium you need in your body? Well, vitamin D. What are we telling everybody to do? Get more vitamin D. But what I found is, and this might explain why it's not in the blood and people aren't getting flagged with hypercalcemia or just high calcium in general, the spinal column functions, from what I read, as a tube, as a storage area for excess calcium. So maybe the body's taking it out of the blood, storing it in the column, and as you get older, it slowly encroaches on your spinal column and results in a stenosis.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And what a lot of people don't know is that there's three hormones to deal with calcium. Calcitonin, parathyroid hormone,
right,
and hormone D. It's not a vitamin, folks, right? It's a hormone. Right. It's a really powerful hormone. And what determines the functionality of those three hormones? Magnesium status.
Right.
If you're a stress cadet, you don't have enough magnesium, then your calcium metabolism is going to be seriously affected, and you're going to start to take on more calcium in a way that you don't want to. And again, it's this mind-numbing reality that, well, there's less magnesium than there is calcium, but magnesium regulates calcium. There's a whisper of copper, but it regulates this massive amount of iron. And again, in the world of acupuncture, copper is called the general, and iron is called the foot soldier. And what's really scary is the speed with which practitioners are adding foot soldiers and killing generals. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize that. They don't know the disconnect there. And I think it's really important for people to recognize that this this pairing of these fat-soluble hormones, it has profound implications for the immune system, for our metabolic pathways, for what we're hearing now is even the musculature and the structure, the skeletal structure, is going to be influenced by the dynamics of these two lipids. Right. And that's, people don't think about that.
Right.
And what I was surprised to learn, and this goes back several months now. Well, actually, I'd learned it a couple of years ago. There was a very important article written by Mawson, M-A-W-S-O-N, 2013. And in that article, Dr. Mawson was talking about A and D and influenza. Really important relationship. Mm-hmm. And again, we've been trained to believe that D is Superman and everything else doesn't matter. It's like, no, that's not true. It's really important to have both. And what that article does is go into a lot of detail about the inner relationship between A and D, because it's a frickin' frack process. But I was looking for a particular reference, and Jim, you'll laugh when you're going to recognize the issue that I was focusing on, which was, I had this intuitive sense that too much D was going to block the absorption of A. And I probably posed that question to you, maybe only 20 times. But in this article by Mawson, he makes reference to a study of chickens. And what they found is that when they fed the chickens high doses of D, retinol didn't get into the system. So I thought, okay, well, at least I have one reference. It's not a very good one, but it'll start. And about a year later, I came back to the Mawson study, and I'm not quite sure how I found it, but there's another study by Conway, C-O-N-W-A-Y, same year, 2013. Well, Conway dug a little deeper, and it turns out he had 7 citations that demonstrated that excess D blocks vitamin A uptake. And people think, yeah, okay, right, so you're just not getting A. Can we get back to the D thing? You know, I know there are people out there that's like, tell me more about this D thing. Like, wait, whoa, slow down. Folks, do you know what vitamin A deficiency causes?
Blindness.
Well, blindness would be one, right?
Right.
Steph, can you think of any conditions you might be concerned about?
Cancer.
Cancer. Ding, ding, ding. Big time. And what's really fascinating about this is that this really was brought to the forefront by a guy who won the Nobel Prize in 1926, Johannes Fibiger, F-I-B-I-G-E-R. And the medal was awarded in 1927. No one knows why. He didn't get it in 26. It was a 26 medal, got it in 27. And he died the next year. But before he died, he wrote this article about how vitamin A deficiency causes cancer. Actually, what it does is, what vitamin A does is it stops proliferation. That's a big deal.
Right.
Why do cancer cells need to have proliferation? Because they're making energy anaerobically, and they need to make a lot of cells to get enough energy to survive.
Right.
So it turns out that there's a connection between retinol status and something called the Warburg effect. People are like, oh my gosh, feels like we're back in school. And you are, because we're trying to teach you what's really going on. And so
you want to share a slide?
Just a couple slides.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let Jim be the only slide guy.
That's right. That wouldn't be fair.
No.
We see how to change the host here. Just bear with me a second.
Take your time. Albert Sven Gorky is one of my heroes. Guy is just an absolute genius. But he said, in every culture and in every medical tradition before ours, healing was accomplished by moving energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's all about. We got to move electrons. That's really what it's about.
Right.
If you can't move electrons, you can't move. You got to work on that electron transport chain. That's where the action is, right? Because we got to turn oxygen into water, and that requires 4 electrons and 4 hydrogen atoms. It's the most important chemical transaction on planet Earth. It's why we're here, folks. It's why we're having this enlightening and engaging conversation, working on these very fancy computers. All higher life forms are based on turning oxygen into water. Pretty cool. So Albert Sven Gorky, brilliant guy. And I could talk about him for an hour. I'm not going to do that. But he's a very, very special guy. And let me just real quickly, we all got through football season. We all got through the Super Bowl, right? But I had an epiphany while I was watching it. And it's one of the most important things, hiding in plain sight. What is a football game without a football? Right? What happens? The guy holding that ball right now in that picture, number 66, what happens when the ball is 1 millimeter above the grass? All hell breaks loose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Game on.
Game's on. Game on. Right? Exactly. guess what copper is in our body? It's the football.
Mm.
And when copper's there, it's game on. And it's absolutely that simple. Think of the energy that's directed at trying to get control of that football. Let it sink in, folks. It's absolutely amazing. That's how important copper is in our metabolism. There's only one football, and it's really tiny. Big 100-yard gridiron. It's called the gridiron. I don't know whether you guys know that. So we're playing with a little copper football on the gridiron. We got a bunch of guys duking it out. These are proteins, enzymes, trying to make things happen. People are probably like, he's losing it, you know. So this is a really important study that I came across by Dr. Hammerling. This is from 2016. Talking about this, folks, this is really heady stuff for a couple slides, and then I'm going to get to the punchline because I want you to really understand. But we're talking about protein kinase C, which is very important mechanism. It's a signaling molecule inside the mitochondria, and it's regulating, according to Dr. Hammerling, mitochondrial energetics. I'm like, what is he talking about? Vitamin A? Huh? And what they discovered is that the cytochrome C, and that's just a fancy term for heme, and cytochrome C expresses the color red. That's really significant when we get inside the mitochondria. But and where is cytochrome C headed? Cytochrome C oxidase, that's complex 4. That's where all the action is. That's where all the players are lined up inside the mitochondria. And it turns out that cytochrome C loves retinol. What? There's retinol? There's retinol in my mitochondria? Yeah, there is. There's, just to put it in perspective, you have 40 quadrillion mitochondria in your body. So that's 15 zeros. So it's about 500 mitochondria per cell. Just throw the biology textbook you used in high school out the window where they had one or two mitochondria. The body's way more complicated than they want us to know. And so there's something called the PKC delta signalosome. Like, oh my God, are we going to get quizzed on this? We should make sure people are listening. But it's a really important piece of the puzzle. And this is a very busy slide that it begins to explain what's going on. But let me go to the, so what you've got down here is these complexes, 1, 3, and 4. And then we've got this dynamic down here. Hold the thought. Don't leave, folks. This is what's really important. And it turns out that the signalosome has 4 parts. I'm going to get back to what Steph was saying about lack of retinol causes cancer. So what's real important is we've got to get the electron in the red box over to the purple box. It's really important. But we've got to get from this signaling molecule to the enzyme. It's really, really important. And so that this box needs to interact with this box, needs to interact with that box, but there's a gotcha. In the center is this mechanism called all trans retinol. And it brings it all together and allows the communication and the electron flow to be perfect. And what happens when you don't have the retinol? You get what's called the Warburg effect. And what does that mean? Otto Warburg said back in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, his most famous saying was in 1966 to a group of Nobel laureates in Switzerland. He said, cancer is a secondary defect. He said, it's actually quite easy to cure cancer. Can you imagine being in that audience, hearing him say that, as people are terrified of the C word?
Right.
He said, you just need to correct the defect in the enzyme. Now, he's a really powerful statement that he made that seems to have been lost by all oncologists on the planet. And guess where the defect is? It's right there. And what people need to understand is that what's running the purple box is copper. And copper and retinol have this incestuous relationship in the same way. And Jim, I know you know this, and you talk about it in very careful ways, in the same way that vitamin D and iron have a relationship. And it's primal, it's ancient. And so vitamin A and copper are essential to make energy. And if they can work together to make energy, all is good. And you're going to have optimal production of ATP. But when copper is missing and or retinol is missing, the bridge doesn't work right. The electrons don't flow right. And everything comes down to a grinding halt. And the mitochondria are really designed to burn fat. That's their preferred fuel. 99.99% of all textbooks talk about glucose metabolism. I've read lots of articles. I found one that actually talked about fat metabolism in the mitochondria. One article. And so the difference is a unit of fat will produce 140 units of energy. A unit of glucose will produce 32. It's a big difference, 140 versus 32. But if you can't work with oxygen, you better have retinol and you better have copper if you're going to work with oxygen. If you can't work with oxygen, you're forced to go anaerobic without oxygen. That's what anaerobic means, right? Without oxygen. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Warburg kicks in. And here's the catch. The Warburg effect is that the tissue is fermenting sugar anaerobically, even though oxygen is present. And there's only one reason why it does that. Because there's no bioavailable copper to work with the oxygen. And what makes copper bioavailable? This retinol thingy, this vitamin A. And so that is completely lost on practitioners because they're preoccupied with chasing enemies and they don't understand how energy is made in the body. And that's why within the RCP, we talk about ignore the enemies, ignite the energy. And it's not really complicated, folks. That's the amazing thing is that I think Jim would agree with me. Once you start to get into the weeds of the research, there's an elegance and a simplicity to this that has been covered over. It's like there's this giant elephant skin of obscurity over these really simple little ideas. And it keeps us from understanding the truth of how the body works. And the thing is, everyone's eating a low-fat diet. There's a real shortage of retinol in our daily diet.
Right.
And our ancestors knew how important it was. They didn't have this knowledge. They didn't know about a signalosome and, you know, anaerobic metabolism and the Warburg effect. They didn't know any of that. They didn't need to. They just knew they felt better when they had a healthy diet that involved mm-hmm. organ meats and lots of fat in the diet and things like that. All that got taken out of our regular diet over the last probably 80 years. And that's what's been missing is this foundational set of nutrients to allow these pathways, like this signalosome, it's fairly complicated. but it's actually pretty simple too. We've got four parts, but the part that ties them all together is that retinol. And if it's not there, then you're going to have a massive breakdown in energy production. And that's why I titled my book, Cure Your Fatigue. Because every condition, every malady, every syndrome, every disease state starts with energy deficiency. And that's the genius of Douglas Wallace at Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. You got to cure the energy problem in order to cure the symptoms. And if you're not making energy, you're making exhaust. It's that simple. Because if oxygen can't be turned into water, it's going to be turned into what are called oxidants. Accidents with oxygen. And they become very reactive. And they're called reactive oxygen species. And so it's, think of copper as a spark plug, and think of retinol as the oil in our engine. And we got to have both. And we've been led to believe that we don't need spark plugs and we don't need oil. And, you know, you just need to flood yourself with this hormone D and everything will be fine. And I think what we've learned from Jim is there is so much that we don't understand, that we've been misled and misfed. And the stimulus for dysregulation from excess D, hypervitaminosis D, is very clearly written in the literature. That's been Jim's appetite for how many years now, Jim?
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah. And so I think what Steph is trying to do here is allow us to have this kind of free-flowing discussion to help people better understand what's going on and really begin to awaken to what else is important, what's really important. And there's nothing more important than mitochondrial energy. Because if you can't make energy, then the body begins to, it's like a top. When the top's spinning really fast, everything's cool. As soon as it starts to lose energy, what does it do? It wobbles and it falls over. Right. And that's what's happening inside people's body. Their immune system pathways are losing energy. Their digestive pathways are losing energy. Their cardiac pathways are losing energy. Their spinal, the part that people don't think about, and it took me the longest time to figure this out. You're talking about spinal stenosis. The spine has a bunch of cells. And guess what those cells need to do? They got to make energy.
Mm-hmm.
They got to make water. And if they can't make water, guess what happens? They dry out, especially the discs. Between those bony parts, you got to have this fluid sac in between. And that comes from water. Well, if you can't make water, it's going to dry out. And people don't realize, again, when you think about your spine, well, it's hard and I don't need to worry about water. Yeah, you do. It's so much more dynamic than we realize. So those are just some intriguing thoughts. And I apologize to the audience for getting into the weeds of the gears, but it's like nobody's talking about this.
Right.
And this idea of this four-part signaling pathway is the actual mechanism to lead to cancer. Well, that's something worth noting and being aware of. And what's really important for people to realize is that if the mitochondria cannot make water, they can't release energy, that means they can't recycle the iron. And guess what cancer cells have? 5 times more iron building in the mitochondria than in the healthy cells next to them. That's a really important statistic to know, that cancer is a breakdown of this signaling pathway. It's a loss of energy, but it's this massive accumulation of iron, and it disrupts the ability to work with oxygen. And then you get into the Warburg effect. And I just think it's beautifully laid out in the research, but you have to stay with it, tease it out, and then kind of step back and admire it from afar, because it takes time to really process all this. And that's what that's the advantage of these conversations, is Steph is giving us a chance to kind of bring people up this learning curve to understand what's also going on that they've never heard about before. So,
right.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it did. And it makes a lot of connections to other things that, in theory, at least, like you were talking about the iron in the cancer. Well, the tumors also express about 300% more vitamin D receptors than the healthy tissue adjacent to them. So there's going to be a connection there. And and the lack of energy.
100%? 300%?
Up to 300% more. Oh. Yeah. And this is all tied, you're talking about the water, which is of course tied to pH. And right. We know mitochondrial dysfunction drives a lot of the diseases. And when you start talking about the fat, then you have to start thinking about, you know, a lot of the autoimmune diseases are collagen vascular diseases, and a lot of diets lack collagen. So all those things go hand in hand on a slippery slope of sliding further into disease states.
So what's your theory about why a tumor cell would increase vitamin D receptors threefold?
What I think is, unfortunately, the literature about that doesn't make clear which type of vitamin D receptors they're expressing. If you remember the last time we talked about how there's the membrane rapid response ones and then there's the nuclear one, I think what they're doing is they're overriding they're using the rapid response ones and overriding the nuclear receptor, which in the long run would make some things that deal with it, you know. But also expressed in tumor cells are these other receptors. This is something I don't think we've talked about, but they're called RORs. They're the orphaned retinoid receptors. Mm-hmm. And they're a really important class of receptors. And they call their membrane one a cytoplasmic one. Mm-hmm. And then they have a nuclear one. These are also expressed in tumors. And these are the ones that actually fight cancer. And those are the molecules that fight cancer. And the RORs, they use the class of molecules, they're vitamin D molecules for retinoid receptors, but they're made in a different pathway. They're made with the CYP11A1 enzyme that used to be the cholesterol side chain cleavage enzyme. That's what it was called before. And this is an enzyme. These are going to be the D molecules that people lack, that are part and parcel to everything. They're at the heart of steroidogenesis. So when your body deals with the star molecule, I don't know if you're familiar with that molecule, that's where pregnenolone comes from. It's the exact same enzyme that makes pregnenolone that would also make those other 15 classes of vitamin D molecules. Mm-hmm. So these are the ones that the body can make when you go in the sun, not typically from D3 inputs.
Wow, that's incredible. So no, I think what's fascinating is that, and I think Jim was right, Steph, at the very least, we need a round three, because I think we're getting into much more depth about why retinol is so important, especially these RORs. There's a subject that we haven't even touched on. There's something called abscisic acid. And if you want your mind blown, you want to be around when Jim starts talking about abscisic acid, because it's fascinating. And it's a parallel universe that we don't know about, because we've all been, you know, told you got to focus on D and ignore everything else. Well, no, let's put D over to the side and let's really begin to put the spotlight on the other nutrients, especially the retinol that's so important.
Yeah, if you'll give me control back, Morley, I'll show you a couple slides real quick. We don't want to talk about them much, but just let's plant some seeds maybe.
So how did you undo
if you click on the three dots by Jim's name, able to make him host.
There it is. Thank you very much. Got it. There we go. You're good.
Okay, here we go. Let's see. Did that come onto your screen?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's the star molecule, and I can't remember right now what it stands for. But you see pregnenolone is made right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll show you the CYP alternative pathway molecules. Try to anyway. I've got two screens, so it's kind of hard to navigate around these.
We're now in the graduate school of Jim. This is so cool.
Now, let's see if I can share this image here. Okay. Did that show up?
Yes, yeah. Sir. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you see at the top here, I can't put cool boxes around it like you, Morley. I'll have to figure that out.
Yeah.
So this is the enzyme I'm talking about right here, CYP11A1. It does that job in the last slide, making pregnenolone.
Right. Right.
And what I've shown you here is, so we've talked about it. So 2,5-D you could call it a second level molecule, D3 being the base. So this right here is equivalent level. It's a hydroxy level.
Yep.
This is a dihydroxy level.
Yep.
The underlined ones are trihydroxies.
Oh my God.
They've been...
Wow.
They're a level higher than 125D. That's why they have three numbers with commas.
Yep.
So these classes of molecules are really, really important right here on the screen. And these are the ones that if we do have a shortage in vitamin D molecules,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be in these molecules that, number one, no one's heard of. Number two, no one's talking about. And number three, no one's measuring. Okay. So these are some of the ones that if you pick one of them off that screen and start looking for articles about it, they will absolutely start to blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'll end up finding all these incredible papers where they fight cancer and stuff like that. Now, I don't want to go any more complex than that. That, like I said, that's called the alternative pathway molecules. And that 20-OHD3 is a really important molecule. And if you ask me, way more important than 25-OHD3.
Which one again?
The one that is in the, let me pull it back up here for you. It's the one in the center there. It's considered a substrate as well as an active molecule.
Yeah.
Right there. This one right, let me move my mouse over there. This one right here. See all the directions it can go?
Yes.
20.
But it does work itself. You know, it has these are amazing molecules, and that's why nobody's ever really heard of them. And like I said, it's at the heart of steroidogenesis. Right there, the body can make pregnenolone or all of the other molecules that are associated with aldosterone, estrogen, all of those. So this is right in the heart of all that.
Wow. I'm fascinated by the CYP11. A1,
right?
It has so many mechanisms that it can influence. I've never even heard of it.
And a lot of people know it as the cholesterol side chain cleavage enzyme. So, you know, that's the thing I've discovered is you have to research what they call the synonyms, but in the chem pages, they call them aliases, which is actually much more appropriate if you ask me. So the other thing I wanted to share, just because I think people find this pretty interesting. I might have mentioned this last time. I don't know. So a lot of the people that still promote D, they have ties to back when rickets was what scared everybody. Everybody fears rickets, and they should, absolutely. And so what people don't understand, and I do think I mentioned it last time, is rickets began because the children were working indoors. Did I talk about that last time?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. So I wanted to share a couple really cool historic photos that, and they are listed as historic photos in some of the literature. That's one of them, definitely. Let me go ahead and show you these. So can you see this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So back in the day when everybody was afraid of rickets, this is what they built for their children. You know, they I don't know if they call
them outside, the baby's outside,
window boxes or not.
Oh my God.
But I have three really cool ones here that I'll show you.
Wow.
I don't know how to change from one to the other.
That's right.
This is in the historic photos.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that one before.
Yeah, that one's a pretty popular one. And then I have, let's see, I have one here.
Wow.
Let's see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is what quelled their fear and also got rid of their rickets. Are you able to see that one?
Yeah.
Should I change it to a third one? Okay. Yeah. So those are pretty cool.
Is this early 1900s?
Yeah, around 1930, you know, and it wasn't long before that we'd actually discovered vitamin D, the vitamin part, you know, and for years we didn't really know there was 2,5-D or 1,2,5-D until much later.
Right.
I will share one other photo that I wanted to share, and I would consider this to be kind of historic. Let's see where I have it here.
For the benefit of the audience, there's pictures that Jim is showing are putting babies in these boxes so they can get sunlight.
Exactly.
And what I don't think scientists or clinicians knew at the time is that when you expose a human to sunlight, two things happen. Yes, you do synthesize vitamin D. I said it correctly, right?
Right.
You do make vitamin D, but what do? You activate the pathway to break down retinol into its retinoids, which are these very critically important components of the lipids that are involved in nuclear transcription. They're involved in all sorts of energy transactions. Right. And again, everything has been with a focus on D and rickets and this and that, D, 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 when in fact, what's playing in the background is retinol metabolism, which is what's saving humanity on this planet.
Yeah.
Because retinol is a light sensor.
Right.
I've got light. I can work with it. Let's grab those photons, as opposed to vitamin D, which is sunglasses. Let's filter the light.
Right.
And people don't realize that it's called the sunshine vitamin, right?
Right.
No, it's the sunglasses vitamin.
That makes sense.
Shuts down light, and people don't realize what that means inside the mitochondria, but that's where its action is.
Right. And those molecules continue to be made from exposure once you create D3. Right. So the degrading of D3 creates a lot of other molecules that they like to refer to as inert, when in fact they're anything but inert. They, you know, D3 reverts to something called lumosterol L3, and then it's a substrate to make molecules in the CYP11A1 pathway. Mm-hmm. And so, and then when it got to rickets, actually, a lot of people don't realize this, they didn't immediately give people D3.
No.
What they did was they used sunshine, they irradiated the cattle's feed, mm-hmm. and the milk. And by the time we were adding D3 directly to things, they had already eradicated rickets. And plus, the child labor laws came into play and the compulsory education came into play. So the kids were either at recess or just not trapped in a work environment in a warehouse all day long. And so rickets was abolished in multiple ways. So
that's amazing. Wow.
This last slide I want to share with you is created by a professor. His name is Stump, S-T-U-M-P-F. Mm. Oh, and he, I know if you search him on PubMed, it credits him with well over 300 papers. And he did a lot of work, and some of his papers, they talk about how when they found out that vitamin D wasn't just the calcium-related vitamin, they abandoned a lot of their focus in certain areas. So when the things that they called calcium sensing receptors, the CSRs, were not influencing calcium, they just put their head down and charged forward, still claiming that it was all about calcium. So this is from one of his papers.
Oh, yeah.
Vitamin D Panacea, I think is what it's called. Right. And you notice he shows more than just the 280 to 320. See, this right here is UVB. This is not. And he didn't even call it what we call it today. I think he called it this because it's from solar forcings, Saltrol. And if you notice that are you able to see the bottom, the plus and the minus inputs at the bottom on this screen?
We're seeing melatonin, and then we're seeing
melanin. So he's calling this the pineal hormone side.
Okay.
You know, so the two inputs, so the pineal gland, which is really important, and we all know it is, and in most people it's, you know, calcified by fluoride by the time you're 17 years old anyway. So how is it going to do its part in this game?
What's important for people to know is that the pineal gland only makes about 2% of the melatonin we need. Most of it's made in the mitochondria throughout the body. This idea that it's a pineal function is just more insanity.
Right. So there's that, giving back control. But I really like that. This Professor Stumpf actually was the one that helped educate Dr. Canal at the Vitamin D Council to become a doctor, because he was a psychiatrist first and foremost.
Right. That's right.
He came up with his theories working in insane asylums where people were sequestered, you know, locked up in rooms where there was no sunlight. And that's where he came up with his theories about vitamin D.
Right. Fascinating. Wow.
Well, I wanted, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I'm trying to picture what Nancy in Missouri is thinking right now.
So I was thinking about Nancy in Missouri, and I wanted to summarize, or not summarize, it's the wrong word. Morley, you brought up an important point about how our ancestors kind of had this intuitive, like they knew what to eat. They had higher fat diets. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, you know, besides the fact that we are marketed to in a way, I don't know about you all. I was taught the food pyramid when I was a child, and I know it's wrong today, but I still have it memorized because that's what I was taught when I was a child. But right. I was thinking, most of the people that I work with or see, they don't know what it feels like to feel good anymore. They've lost sense of, oh, this is what having energy feels like. This is what it feels like to not need a cup of coffee at 3 p.m. This is what it feels like to, you know, honestly, a common complaint that I get is, I don't have the energy to go to Target. And most people live probably 10, 15 minutes away from a Target. That shouldn't be, you know, a tasking. So just this, so not only are we taught wrong information, right? But we also have a lost sense of ourselves, and we don't, you know, intuitive eating. How can people do that when they don't know how they feel when they feel good? And nobody gets labs done when they feel good, right? You get labs drawn when you feel bad, and you go, well, it would be nice to know objectively what you look like when you feel good, because.
Right. It's very true.
You know, I was just, I'm just thinking about the people I see and work with, and they're listening to this and thinking, this ancestral eating, you know, yeah, that sounds great. How would I begin that? How would I know?
Mm-hmm.
And how would I monitor what feeling good is like?
I think people just need to be more curious. I mean, I know people agree. Don't feel well, and we spell it differently. That's C-U hyphen. So you can see the symbol for copper.
Yeah.
Folks, I'm telling you, it's only a few nutrients that are missing in our diet, but those are the critical few. And if you don't have the copper, and if you don't have the magnesium, and if you don't have the retinol, and, you know, a handful of others, it makes a huge impact on the body's ability to communicate, make energy, pass electrons. It's just, and the overabundant obsession about hormone D, thinking that that's going to solve all your ills. I'm actually shocked at the number of practitioners who they're presented with a very compromised individual, and all they zero in on is vitamin D. Yeah, we gotta bring your D up. Like that's gonna suddenly change everything. It's like, no, it's really unfortunate that there isn't a deeper understanding of these other parameters. And it doesn't have to be complicated. You just need to know, how is energy really made in the body? And it's a beautiful thing. And once you understand the water wheel, and then you understand that if it's not making water, it becomes a Ferris wheel. Well, then you're just going around and around and nothing's happening. So people just need to step back from the programming, the mainstream programming, and begin to think, what would my ancestors do? What did they eat? You know, Weston A. Price is a wonderful resource for what our ancestors used to eat. It's not perfect, but it's damn good. And so let's start there. Let's make sure that we are drinking water with minerals in it. Let's make sure that we're eating the right kinds of foods that are going to deliver the nutrients that run our mitochondria.
Yeah.
And there are minerals that run the mitochondria. There's, I think we talked about it last time, there's a little pool in the center of every mitochondria. It's called the copper matrix pool. Oh, there's a matrix inside our mitochondria? Yeah, there's a lot of copper swimming in that pool. And who knew? You know, I didn't know that until a few years ago. And thank heavens for someone like Paul Cobine at Auburn University who figured it out. It's just, it's like the information is out there. It absolutely is out there. Steph is tapping into this all the time, which I think is really cool, connecting the dots for people. But you just need to act on it. You need to be willing to make changes in your routine and just see, I wonder how I would feel if I did this or if I did that. And you might be pleasantly surprised when you do that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think you're, when you talk about ancestral diet, not the fad, let's say, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but you need to truly think of your ancestors. I know that I had a great grandfather and a great grandmother, not together, but from separate lines of the family, that lived into their late 90s. And they had gardens in their backyard, and they still did bad things. My great-grandfather chewed Red Man tobacco and drank Davis County whiskey to cut the chill, you know, and still they weren't, they got old when they got old, but they were sharp. My great-grandmother taught for 56 years, and she retired in her 80s, and she still drove her car. So think about the foods that they ate, try to mirror that in unadulterated, you know, form, like heirloom this and that, and you're really onto something. People are conditioned that they need to absolutely enjoy their food. It needs to be almost a form of entertainment. You know, there's a lot of hunter-gatherers don't necessarily enjoy their food, but they want to stay alive. Same thing in the animal world. But then think about plants. They're unable to move to a better environment. And what do they have going for them? They have the nutrients in the soil and good water and sun. So you got to get back to the basics. You can take foods that are good for you and find ways to make them taste good. But you may need to just suck it up a little bit and eat some stuff that isn't, you know, you're not going to rave about it, but move forward from there and work on your health. I always think about what, in Minding Our Mitochondria, in the TED Talk by Terry Walls, where she talks about who's eating the big plates of greens, raise your hand. Who's eating two plates, raise your hands. And it gets back to the things that we haven't discovered that are possibly in those foods as well. And I would suggest that people look at juicing, true juicing, not blender style juicing that's really common today, but the kind of juicing that truly extracts the nutrients. Because people don't really realize how dynamic true juicing can be. You can get out of one apple what you might have to eat 12 to get for your body to be able to liberate it. And so you might need to start out, you know, really hardcore until you get your energy back and find ways to prepare all those good foods and, you know, eat a rainbow of colors and just figure it out. You don't have to. The top part of your day does not need to be a scrumptious meal. Your health needs to be your top priority and feeling good, because you're limited in the amount of time you spent enjoying a meal, whereas you're miserable all day outside that time. You know, a day is very long. You spend very little of that time actually consuming food. So why don't you focus on the lion's share of your day and make that your priority?
Nice.
That's a good note to end on.
Yeah. I don't remember who is the host, but if somebody can make me the host,
control again. That's me.
I don't want to lose the recording. That's what I'm nervous about.
There we go.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, great. Yes. Okay. Well, goodness, we have covered so much ground today. I am totally up for a round three. This episode, let's see, your first episode, your part one is going to air tomorrow. Part two is going to air in April. So maybe we could reconvene after this episode goes live and do, so my community is really responsive. Like, I'm sure that they will have questions. Because y'all talked about a lot of different things, right. Put a lot of information on the table. I tried to take a bunch of notes and I wrote down all the studies too.
What I think would be fun is, I can't wait, you know, I think Jim and I feel the same way about questions. We love answering them. But I think what would be also helpful is to know, what did you enjoy most about what you learned? What was the biggest surprise? What was the big aha? Oh, I didn't know that. I think there needs to be some validation and reinforcement of the breakthrough information that's being shared here. It's not about ego. It's about, we're just trying to get the truth out. And how is it being received in the community? That would be very helpful to know.
Okay.
That. Because we know there are going to be questions. But what do you feel good about? What really is aligning with what your expectations are? I think that's important.
Yeah, too. People will answer that for sure. I've written that down. And I've got links to Jim's Facebook page, Substack. Morley, I've got all of your links too. Well, thank you both for being
today. Thanks for having us.
Y'all are my favorite. So any chance I can get to talk to either one of you, both of you, it's just a dream come true because, you know, it took me a long time to get here, right? I didn't automatically think, oh, iron is the bad guy or vitamin D. Those were not, you know, I grew up in Bedford Falls. Those weren't my thoughts, but I did have many aha moments working in the hospital where I was like, something's not, why are we having so many 42-year-olds getting these surgeries? Or why do people my age, why are they coming to the hospital? Why do they have so many diagnoses? Look at their med list. Oh my word. Why are they on so many medications? This isn't, something's not right here. And so that of course sparked a lot of questions. But I didn't get to where I am today, like without your guidance and expertise, because this information, and I've told Morley, I've had countless conversations with you about how this stuff isn't easy to find. You really have to dig for this information. It's not in plain sight. And in fact, you have to be really cautious because a lot of the information you do find is wrong. So
what's the battle is asking the right question.
Right. And you're right. The stuff that I know about vitamin D, it didn't come in a newsletter. It wasn't on the cover of the paper or in the magazine. I had to punch in a molecule and either a symptom I specifically searched for most of the stuff that I have. And that's how I found it. You know, most people think they did research when they search vitamin D deficiency. You're not going to find anything but mainstream hoopla when you do that.
The key, I think, is being not cynical, but being skeptical, saying, is there more to the story? Is there something that I don't know that I need to know? And I think that's the fuel that Jim and I have used, and I think, Steph, you use in your work as well, is questioning the narrative, saying, is there more to the story? Is there something that nature wants me to know that the narrative does not want us to know?
Right.
Well, yeah. The thing is, these people weren't getting better. You know, you've probably heard the term frequent flyers.
Sure.
We had a lot of people, a lot of folks come that would be at multiple readmissions. And I hate this, but the blame is automatically put on the patient. Well, you know, Mr. Jones didn't do so-and-so, or he didn't.
Right.
And my original thought is, no, we didn't fix his problem because he's back. So what were the interventions? Why didn't they work? And that, you know, I don't need to tell you all, you know, that's a common story. You know, people are readmitted. That's the game. So it's just,
We have the benefit of the last 2 years to help us understand, wow, there really is more to the story. So from that standpoint, that's been a godsend because it's given us a springboard to say there is more to the story. Let's start to dig for it. So that's what these conversations are about.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for being here.
You're welcome.
So grateful for you. And listeners, stay tuned.
All right.
Goodness, we covered a lot today. I hope you found this information helpful, and I also hope that you're leaving today with more questions than answers. We will be doing a part 3, which will be a Q&A, so feel free to submit your questions in my private Facebook community, which is called Revolutionary Health, or you can email your questions to info.holistichouse@gmail.com. All right, friends, it's time to go back out into the real world now. Be well and be kind.